And during that time, he had a near-death experience in which he was in a pastoral scene and saw this nurse walking towards him. And he said, "Anita, what are you doing here?" Because he recognized this wasn't Earth. And she said, "You know, Jack, you can't stay here. You need to go back. I want you to tell my parents I love them very much, and I'm sorry I wrecked the red MGB." So he woke up with complete memory of this experience and started to tell the first nurse he saw, who got very upset and ran out of the room. And it turned out, after he investigated this, that the nurse had taken the weekend off to celebrate her 21st birthday, and her parents surprised her with the gift of a red MGB. And she got excited, jumped in the car, and took off for a drive, crashed into a telephone pole, and died a few hours before his near-death experience. There's no way he could have known that she had died, and no way he could have known how she died, and yet he did.
Hi all, this is Mind the Shift, and I am Anders. We are going to explore today in this episode one of my favorite topics, one that has is in connection with the essence of what it is to be a human being, near-death experiences. It is a joy and an honor to introduce Professor Bruce Grayson, one of the world's leading experts on NDEs. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thank you, Anders. I'm very happy to be here with you today.
You are a professor emeritus of psychiatry and neurobehavioral, it's a difficult word, neurobehavioral sciences at the University of Virginia.
Right.
And at the Division of Perceptual Studies at said university, you have for decades now scientifically studied together with Ian Stevens and Jim Tucker and others, the borderline between life and death, you might say.
That's right.
And you are the author, as far as I understand, of a book on the subject entitled After, released in 2021, was it?
That's right.
Yeah. And you are, as far as I understand, a co-author of a very, very well-read book, I would say, Irreducible Mind from 2006.
Yes, yes.
Was that about a more or less a fair description of your CV there?
That is very good. Very good.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Excellent. Now, this research that you are conducting is, of course, very serious. I mean, it's science after all. But yet many people seem to still not be aware that this has been going on for decades. Am I right?
That's right. That's right. Especially among scientists, they're not aware of it. They don't seem to be aware of it.
Why is that, do you think?
Well, I think part of it is that they come to the field with a bias based on what their background has been, what their training has been. And I understand that because I had the same training. I was brought up as a materialist and trained through college and medical school to think that the physical world is all there is. And with that understanding, then near-death experiences just can't occur. They can't be real. People are making these things up, or else they're hallucinations of some kind. And you need to get beyond that mindset, that materialistic mindset, which is not scientific, it's a philosophical mindset, before you can accept that near-death experiences are real and what their implications are.
So how often would you say that your work has been or is brushed aside as pseudoscience?
Well, I'll say that it's getting less and less common that that would happen. When we used to talk at large medical conventions 40 years ago, there would be a polite silence in the audience as people wondered why we were up there talking about these silly things. And now when we talk to the same conferences, it's rare that doctors don't get up in the audience and say, "Let me tell you about my experience, my near-death experience." So it's becoming much more widely accepted now than it was when we first started doing this research decades ago.
Well, that's great. There's a TV series on Netflix called Surviving Death, and I've seen it a couple of times. I think it's great, especially it's six episodes, and especially episode one and six are good. And you feature in the first, and I think also in the last episode of that series. Or
actually, remember. Jim Tucker was in the last episode.
Okay, Jim Tucker's there. Anyway, how much do you think that series has meant for the the general understanding among the public that this is a scientific discipline?
Well, it has helped. I'm not sure it helped promote the scientific aspect of it. It helped promote the awareness of the phenomenon, but it kind of glossed over all the better scientific research, particularly in other fields other than near-death experiences, and just talked about phenomena that may or may not be legitimate.
Yeah. So how did it all begin for you? I mean, you mentioned that you were once upon a time also a materialist mainstream doctor. And I have heard you talk about this, but the audience might not know exactly what happened. So there were some changes, that something happened that made you start thinking about these things. So can you tell us a little bit about that background and how it all began?
Sure. Well, after I finished my medical school training, I was an intern at the hospital in psychiatry, and I was asked to see a patient. And when I went down to see her, she had overdosed and she was unconscious. I could not arouse her. But her roommate was waiting to talk to me in another room about 50 yards down the hall, 50 meters down the hall. So I went to talk to the roommate. And when I finished, I went back to see the patient again, and she was still unconscious. So I arranged for her to be admitted to the intensive care unit overnight. And I went to see her the next morning. And she was still quite drowsy. I had a hard time arousing her. And I started by introducing myself, and she stopped me and said, "I know who you are. I remember you from last night." And that kind of puzzled me because I thought she was out cold the night before. So I said that to her. I said, "I thought you were unconscious." And she said, I didn't see you in my room. I saw you talking to Susan down the hall." And I didn't know what to make of that. I thought she was playing a trick on me. And then she started to tell me details about my conversation with her roommate that she couldn't possibly have known. And I thought, well, I'm a new intern here. The nurses are playing a trick on me. Something's going on. This can't be real. But I didn't have time then to deal with that because I was there to help her with her suicidal thoughts. So I just had to push it out of my mind. But over the next few months and years, I started hearing more and more of these stories. And of course, they were coming to me from psychiatric patients, who was what I was treating. So I kind of dismissed them as, well, these are crazy people. Who knows what they're thinking? And then in 1975, a few years later, my colleague Raymond Moody published a book called Life After Life, in which he gave us the term in English, near-death experience. It had been used in French a century ago, but he gave us the first.
So that was the first time that I was introduced in English, scientific.
Yeah. And in his book, he had about 150 cases, not from psychiatric patients, but from everyday normal people who were having the same types of phenomena that couldn't possibly be real from a materialistic perspective. So I thought, well, I'm a scientist. I need to find out what's going on here. If you're really a scientist, you don't run away from things you don't understand. You run towards them, trying to understand them. So I started collecting more and more cases, not only from my patients, but from other people as well, and trying to find patterns and trying to find explanations for them. When I started off, I was pretty sure I would find a simple physiological explanation. But the more I've studied this, the less plausible that seems.
Okay, so yeah, well, that book you mentioned there, Life After Life by Raymond Moody, was a very pivotal book. I think I have it here in my bookshelf, and many people refer to it as a starting point for these kinds of ponderings and also research. So, I mean, there are different aspects of this life-death borderline, if you like near-death experiences that we're talking about right now here, but also spiritually transformative experiences, STEs is another term that they're talking about, past life memories, out-of-body experiences, mediumship, etc. Is it fair to say that your primary line of, and I know that the university where you have been working deals with all different kinds of phenomena like the ones I just mentioned. But is it fair to say that your primary line of research has been near-death experiences?
It has been for most of the past 50 years. In the last few years, I've gotten more and more interested in something called terminal lucidity.
What is that?
In which people who have had degenerative brain diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia, who have not been able to recognize family members for months or years and unable to communicate, suddenly become completely lucid again for no apparent reason. And there's no medical explanation for this. There's no, they can't regenerate the brain cells. And then in a matter of hours or occasionally days, they die. And there's no explanation for this. In fact, it's sometimes very sad for the family because they get excited thinking, oh, she's getting better. And it turns out that she's not. She's just getting ready to die. So it seems that this happens in the waning moments of someone's life. And we don't know why that would be. If you don't accept materialism, you can believe that as the brain is deteriorating, it loosens its hold, its grip on consciousness, and more things can come into the mind, into the consciousness, than the brain usually lets in. And this allows them to start recognizing people and communicating again just before they die.
Yeah, that's a fascinating phenomenon. I've actually talked about people who work hospices and things like that and asked about this. And they corroborate what you're just saying, that this is very common, actually. The 2 days before they die, they just kind of... Was it called terminal lucidity, or what was the term?
That's the name that Michael Naum, a German researcher, and I gave to it about 8 years ago. There was no name for it before that, and we had scoured the literature in medical journals for the past 100 years. We found about 80 cases, but they were not given any particular name, so it was hard to find them all. But it's been known for centuries. It just hadn't been lumped together as a phenomenon until we started looking at it. And now there's a lot of research going on into this phenomenon.
Yes, I suppose that this phenomenon has been more common historically than NDEs, actually, because of the fact that, as you have talked about and many others, that our ability to resuscitate people with cardiac arrest increased enormously from the 60s onwards. So, which means that, I mean, the study basis, so to speak, has grown enormously since then. Is that right?
That's true. On the other hand, we have cases of near-death experiences from ancient Greece and Rome and in Egypt that sound just like the ones we hear today from, example, people who are wounded in battle and thought to be dead, and then they sometimes recover on the funeral pyre and talk about their voyages to another realm. And this happens not only in Western cultures, but in Eastern cultures as well, and in third world countries where they don't have the same concepts of heaven and hell and God that we do.
Yeah, I understand. But still, I mean, from having been maybe a few hundreds or a few thousands a year, now there are millions of cases, aren't there?
There are. It's hard to know whether the number is actually increasing because people's feelings of safety in talking about these things is also increasing. And mm-hmm. I've talked to many people who had the experiences 50, 60 years ago who have never forgotten it, but were afraid to talk about it until recently. And it's been only in the recent few decades that people have felt it's safe to talk about these things without being called crazy.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more in detail about near-death experiences and what they entail. This is a threefold question, and you should never ask threefold questions, but I think you're used to hearing these three, and I think you can answer them, so I'll just say them all three, because I want to know when these experiences occur and how common they are and what are some common features.
Right. Well, the question about when they occur depends on how you define the phenomenon. Things that sound just like near-death experiences usually occur when someone is either pronounced dead or very, very close to death, when their hearts are stopping, for example. But we hear the same kinds of experiences from people who simply fear they are going to die, but they are not physiologically impaired. Their hearts are not stopping. For example, people who fall off mountains. The first collection of cases was published in 1892 by a Swiss alpine climber who fell and had a beautiful near-death experience on the way down, and he wrote it up and published it, And he was so fascinated by this that he asked other climbers and quickly found 30 other cases just like his. So he published this in the yearbook of the Swiss Alpine Club in 1892. So what happens when people are near death, psychologically or physiologically? We also see similar experiences in other phenomena. You mentioned spiritually transformative experiences. They can happen in meditation. In a variety, most cultures have developed techniques for inducing these experiences, whether it's drumming or dancing or flagellating themselves and so forth, starvation. And they have the same effect as bringing about a near-death event. They get someone out of their physical body, so to speak, and let them sense some other realm or dimension of being. You also asked how common these are. Again, that's difficult to tell because people are still not willing to always acknowledge that they've had this. But most of the research that's been done, both in the United States and in European countries, has suggested that about 5% of the general population has had a near-death experience. That's one out of every 20 people. That's a lot of people.
A lot of people, yeah.
Very common. As a psychiatrist, I've also tried to look at the interaction of mental illness and near-death experiences. And any way we look at this, we find no connection at all. People who have serious mental illnesses have the same rate of NDEs, near-death experiences, as other people do. And people who have near-death experiences have the same rates of mental illness as other people do. So there's no connection between mental illness and near-death experiences. As for the features, commonly people notice that their thoughts are very different than they normally are. They're thinking faster and clearer than ever before. They may have a complete review of their entire lives in very great detail. They often have very strong emotions, usually positive, feeling an intense feeling of peace and well-being, sometimes joy. They often feel like they are in the presence of a beautiful, loving light. It's not like a light bulb, it's like the sun. It's a living entity that radiates warmth and love and unconditional love towards them. They also have what we call paranormal phenomena, for lack of a better word. They feel they are leaving the physical body. They often may feel they have visions of the future. And they may feel like they have extrasensory perception, being aware of things beyond the range of their senses. And then we have phenomena that seem to suggest some other realm or dimension of being. For example, people will feel they have left the earth behind and have gone to some other type of existence. They may see and hear deceased loved ones or other beings that they consider deities. And at some point, they may come to a border or point of no return beyond which they can't keep going and still come back to life.
And these features are common among all people who have this, or is this a sample? I mean, is it some people have had? I understand some people have more negative experiences, which are not very common, but they exist.
And then, right, they do exist. Again, it's hard to know how often because people who have unpleasant experiences are even less willing to talk about them than people who have pleasant ones. Mm-hmm. They think that something must be wrong with me because I had a hellish experience. Well, they're not really hellish per se. Often they sound just like the positive, blissful experience, but they are experienced in an unpleasant way. For example, people may, in a pleasant experience, they may feel themselves going through a tunnel to a beautiful light that's radiating love and warmth. And people who have an unpleasant experience may feel themselves ripped out of their bodies and thrust down a tunnel at blinding speed and confronting this horrible light. And these are usually people who have a strong need to be in control in their lives. And whatever the near-death experience consists of, you're not in control of it. Something else is, if anything is. And that sense of being out of control is very terrifying. And that makes it a very unpleasant experience. At some point during the experience, many of these people will give up trying to fight. They'll get exhausted and they'll just surrender. And as soon as they do, it becomes a blissful experience for them. So what was unpleasant was the resistance to it, not the experience itself. Other people have had an experience of being in a black void with nothing, no sight, no sound, just nothing but their own consciousness. And they feel themselves in that environment for eternity. And that is very terrifying for most Americans and probably most Europeans, the sense of being totally alone in the universe. Now, I've also talked to people who were raised in a Hindu culture who had the same experience and thought that was blissful, that was nirvana. So it's some of it is colored by your cultural expectations.
Interesting. Mm.
Yeah.
Cultural differences. Well, actually, when you meditate, which I try to do every day here, it's ups and downs, but for the most part, I think I end up in some kind of a void or something.
Yes.
Which is a very nice feeling, but yeah, anyway. So I guess to convince people who are very skeptical, that might not have to be a goal, but it's nice to be able to convince people that this is actually happening, because many people would discard these stories as just stories and the tricks of the brain, and we can go deeper down into that in a minute. But I guess that to convince people who are skeptical, it is important that that people who had these experiences also kind of, when they are out of their body, that they can hear stories being told, like you were telling about the first time you ran into this when you were a young doctor, then, or they can see things, for instance, placed in parts of the hospital which they wouldn't possibly be aware of hadn't they been able to travel outside of the body, and things like that. So are those things also common, and do you think it's important to document these things?
I think it is important to document them, because most people who are skeptical of near-death experiences will say, oh, you're misremembering, or it didn't really happen. So it's important to document them at the time they happen and to get as much corroborating evidence as possible. Let me give you an example. One fellow I knew in his mid-50s had a terrible chest pain. He was rushed to the hospital, and he ended up having quadruple bypass surgery. Four of the large vessels supplying his heart were completely clogged, and he had to have them all replaced. So in the middle of this open heart surgery, he later told me, he found himself rising up out of his body and looking down at his body on the operating table. And he saw his surgeon flapping his arms like he was trying to fly, and he demonstrated that for me. It was hard for me not to laugh when I heard that, because I've been a doctor for like 30 years at that time. I'd never heard anything so ridiculous in my life. You don't see doctors on television doing that kind of thing.
No.
So I said to him, this sounds to me more like a hallucination from the anesthesia. He said, no, it really happened. I saw it. You can ask my doctor. So I did. I talked to his surgeon, and his surgeon, who was a very straight-laced, no-nonsense type of guy, said, no, this is true. I did do that. I've developed this unique habit. I've never seen anyone else do it. I let my assistants start the procedure while I put on my sterile gown and gloves, and I walk into the operating room with my sterile gloves on, and I watch them start the procedure. And I don't want to risk touching anything that's not sterile, so I put my hands where I know they won't touch anything, flat against my chest. And then I point things out to them with my elbows, so I won't risk touching anything. And he demonstrated just the way the patient did.
Fascinating.
I don't know how he knew that. When he actually said that, he's told that to the surgeon the day after the surgery. And the surgeon got very upset, thought he was accusing him of malpractice, and said, well, you're still alive, aren't you? I must have done something right.
He didn't get the point, but still, I mean, I can understand the question as well.
So one of my colleagues, Jan Holden at the University of North Texas, actually looked into more than 100 cases where what the patient seemed to say happened while they were unconscious could be corroborated, or potentially corroborated, by some third party, a doctor, a nurse, someone by the bedside. And she found that in 92% of these cases, the description was entirely accurate. In 6%, there was some accuracy, but a few mistakes. And only 1% was it totally wrong. So the vast, vast majority of these cases seem to be accurate as far as we can tell. And we don't really have a good explanation for how this can be. Certainly, most of the operations that we see, these surgical procedures, patients are unconscious. And we know that from the monitoring. And often they have their eyes taped shut so they won't, because you don't blink when you're under anesthesia and your eyes can dry out. So people can still see despite their eyes being shut and being unconscious. And there's no medical explanation for that.
And there's basically no brain activity. The brains are flatlined during this.
Well, we usually don't have brainwave measurements during a procedure. But we know, for example, during cardiac arrest, there's no blood going to the brain, so the brain is effectively flatlined. But there's actually something even more phenomenal to me that's even harder to explain. Many people will have an experience during the near-death experience of encountering deceased loved ones. And that can be dismissed in many cases as being wishful thinking or expectation. You know, I think I'm going to die. Of course, I want to see my deceased grandfather. So you imagine that. But there are a number of cases in which people in a near-death experience encountered deceased individuals who were not known to have died. So it wasn't expectation that led to this. We have a lot of very good cases of this. I published an account of 30 of these cases about a decade ago. But we have cases going back to ancient Rome. Pliny the Elder wrote about one of these cases in the first century. So they're not new by any means. And I don't know how to explain these phenomena unless you assume that the deceased individual is still alive in some sense and able to communicate.
Yes, I was going to ask you about one of those cases. Maybe it was you who wrote or told or talked about this in some interview, because there was a case, some man who had flatlined, who was clinically dead and met a person who was, I think, from South Africa or something.
Yes.
And this person, I think it was a woman, told him to, can you please tell such and such at this and this address and this phone number that I'm okay or something like that. And then when he woke up, he immediately told the nurse, I met this person. We need to contact this and this person. And they did so. And it turned out that the relatives of this person didn't know that this person was dead because she had died in a car accident out in the wilderness somewhere. Is that the case that you were talking about? Or
Yes, sort of. So this was a 25-year-old fellow in South Africa who was hospitalized with severe pneumonia, and he had respiratory arrest. He couldn't breathe. And he had one nurse that worked with him every day and got to know him pretty well. And one day she told him that she was taking a long weekend off, and she said that the other nurse was substituting for her. So she left. And while she was gone, he had another respiratory arrest where he had to be resuscitated. And during that time, he had a near-death experience in which he was in a pastoral scene and saw this nurse walking towards him. And he said, Anita, what are you doing here? Because he recognized this wasn't Earth. And she said, you know, Jack, you can't stay here. You need to go back. I want you to tell my parents I love them very much, and I'm sorry I wrecked the red MGB. This was in the 1970s in South Africa. There weren't a lot of MGBs there. So he woke up with complete memory of this experience and started to tell the first nurse he saw, who got very upset and ran out of the room. And it turned out, after he investigated this, that the nurse had taken the weekend off to celebrate her 21st birthday, and her parents surprised her with the gift of a red MGB. And she got excited, jumped in the car, and took off for a drive, crashed into a telephone pole, and died a few hours before his near-death experience. There's no way he could have known that she had died or wanted her to have died, and no way he could have known how she died, and yet he did. And we have many, many cases like this that are verified by other people.
Yeah, okay. So I hadn't gotten it completely right, but I'm very happy that you told that story. It's just fascinating. It's stuck in my mind. So how does standard science try to explain NDEs, and why are these explanations wrong, which I assume that you think they are?
Yeah. Well, when I started doing this research, I assumed there was a simple scientific explanation. So I started testing different hypotheses. For example, the idea that a lack of oxygen is causing these hallucinations. And what we found is that in the few studies where oxygen has been measured when people come close to death, those people who have near-death experiences actually have better oxygen supply than those who don't. And what that means is that if you don't have much oxygen going to the brain, you don't remember later on your near-death experience. But at any rate, it doesn't mean that lack of oxygen causes the experience. We've also looked at drugs people are given as they approach death, and we find that the fewer drugs people are given, the more likely they are to tell about a near-death experience, and the more elaborate the experience is. It's possible that there's some drug produced in the brain as people are dying that may have hallucinogenic effects. There have been a lot of hypotheses about this. There's many things that have been proposed, but none of them have really been tested. We don't have any data explaining that. But all these hypotheses assume that the brain is capable of producing these elaborate experiences, which most people say is the most detailed and vivid experience of their lives, at a time when the brain is demonstrably impaired, if not offline entirely. And if we did find a physiological phenomenon that was associated with near-death experiences, that wouldn't explain how people were able to see things accurately from outside their bodies, or how they could encounter people who were dead and no one knew they were dead yet. So I don't think those physiological explanations can really explain anything.
Do you think it's the same mechanism, or whatever you should call it, that is going on when people have these terminal lucidity when people have near-death experiences?
It may be. We are normally taught in school that the brain creates our thoughts and our feelings and our perceptions. A popular way of saying this is they say that the mind is what the brain does. And if you believe that, then there's no way you can have a near-death experience or terminal lucidity. But there's been another thought that's been going on for thousands of years that says the brain doesn't create thoughts. The mind is somewhere else, I don't know where. And what the brain does is receive these thoughts and filter them and let in to your consciousness only those thoughts that are important to survival. This is not surprising because all our sense organs do this. Our eyes don't let in all the light that's available, just a small section of the electromagnetic spectrum that's relevant to our survival. So we don't see light colors that other animals do, infrared, ultraviolet, because they're not important to us. So the brain restricts what we see to what is necessary for physical survival. And the idea is that the brain does this with thoughts as well. It only lets in those thoughts that are important to surviving, finding food, finding shelter, finding a mate, avoiding predators. And it filters out all those things that are not important to survival, like seeing deceased loved ones or communicating with deities. Those aren't important to surviving in the physical world.
Would even be confusing to see them all the time, I guess.
Right. And this has been, Hippocrates talked about this 2,000 years ago. He said, the brain is the interpreter of the mind. And there's been a secondary thread of thought throughout science for the last 2,000 years looking at this. And in the last decade or so, there's been a lot of research into what parts of the brain are involved in this filtering process. And there's been some progress made along these lines. We also see, for example, in psychedelic drugs, which people have maybe spiritually transformative experiences under psychedelic drugs. We used to think that these drugs work by making people hallucinate, by stimulating the brain so it hallucinates. And what we found in the last 20 years or so is that when people take these drugs and start having near-death-like experiences, spiritually transformative experiences, their brain activity actually decreases and becomes less coordinated. So again, it's like the brain is shutting down, letting this consciousness come in. And that may be what's happening in terminal lucidity as well.
Yeah.
That as the brain deteriorates near death, it lets all sorts of things in that it normally would filter out.
So it's like the brain has to, as it were, get out of the way in order for people to have these experiences, to get access to what is actually there on the other side of the veil, as it were.
Right.
Yeah. And this thing you said about psychedelics and that the brain actually shows less activity when people take those, that must have been a real blow to the materialists.
Well, they're desperately
That was 10 years ago or something like that?
Yeah. There's been several studies of that over the past 10, 15 years. And they're desperately trying to find some way of getting around that, looking at various more subtle measures of brain activity. Maybe there's something else going on we aren't aware of. But people have used the metaphor of looking up at the sky during the day, and you don't see any stars because the sun is so bright it blocks them out. It's only at night when the sun goes down that you see the stars. Not that the stars weren't there, they just were blocked. And that's the way the sun, I mean, the brain filters out thoughts for us. Only when the brain's out of the way can you see these other things.
Yeah, there's been some interesting development in the consciousness research lately, and most of it, I guess, is still standard science. It's physicalist in some way, but it's there is some movement going on. But it seems sometimes newspapers and the media misrepresent what these new consciousness studies actually show. There was one recently conducted by Dr. Sam Parnia. New York University, I think, on patients who were temporarily clinically dead after cardiac arrest. And there were some media reports claiming certain types of brain activity that they detected there could explain NDEs, but it really didn't do that, did it?
No.
I know you have written about this.
Yes.
You and Pim van Lommel.
Yes. They studied more than 500 patients who were in cardiac arrest. And they were only able to get usable brainwave measurements in about 50 of them. It's very hard to do because people are being defibrillated, and they're being pounded on their chests, and these create huge electromagnetic waves that are much more powerful than the brainwaves. So they kind of mask it. But they claim that they found in a small number of patients waves that resembled brainwaves that can be associated with consciousness. Now, none of those patients that they found these brainwaves in had near-death experiences. On the other hand, they did find, I think it was 11 patients who had near-death experiences in their sample, but none of them showed these brainwaves.
So it's the other way around, really.
So yeah, I mean, they did show something that may be worth looking into, but it did not show a correlation between near-death experiences and this persistent brainwave activity.
But as far as I understand, Dr. Sam Parnia is researching this from that kind of materialistic perspective, is he?
Well, I think he would deny that it's just from a materialistic perspective.
Yeah.
I think he wants to take a larger perspective than that. And he's also, for example, putting hidden targets in the rooms where these things happen. Targets above eye level facing upwards, so they can only be seen by looking down from the ceiling. And he's hoping that some patients will actually be able to identify the target from looking above when they leave their bodies. And he hasn't found any yet, but he is still looking into that.
Yeah, okay. I didn't know that he was the one conducting that kind of experiment. I interviewed Pim van Lommel a year ago or so and asked about that. And he mentioned that also. And he said that, which was very, I think, insightful, that people who have near-death experiences and leave their body, I mean, it's not the first thing that they concentrate on to look for symbols and things that others have placed close to the ceiling. They have other things in mind.
Right. There have actually been 6 different researchers who have published studies like this, and none of them found any evidence that people can, or the people did, look at the target. Okay. So, you know, it may be that they're not motivated to do so. It would be like, you know, you take a trip to some other country, and at least you claim you do. Who knows whether you really did or not. But when you come back, you went through customs and so forth, and someone says, well, I want to test whether you really went to this other country. So tell me, what was the name of the customs officer who looked in your when you came back? Because his name was right on his chest. You should have seen it. Well, you weren't paying attention to that. So, of course, you didn't see it.
That's
that
a good analogy.
Your trip. Yeah.
Very good. Do you have any thoughts on the recent consciousness research? For instance, there's a feud going on now around what is called IIT, Integral Information Theory, I think. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yes.
It's kind of on its way towards panpsychism, but it's not really panpsychism. But it's like there's a movement towards, you know, this, the difference between thinking that consciousness is primary and precedes matter, or the other materialistic side is to see matter as primary, and that matter must produce consciousness. But this is kind of moving towards the the consciousness is primary side. Do you have any thoughts on what's going on there in that field?
Well, that's really beyond my level of expertise. I'm a clinical psychiatrist. I'm a physician, and this requires knowledge of physics that I really don't have to understand these things. My colleagues who are in this field think that it's not quite there yet. This it's maybe going in the right direction, but it hasn't quite been able to explain things yet. But as you said, there's lots of different theories out there now that are trying to explain what's going on here with consciousness in the brain. And they're all making good stabs at it, but I don't think any of them have really explained it yet.
No, I guess it's a leap of faith to just leave that, you know, to center on the brain so much, to assume that the brain is the producer of everything.
Well, more than 100 years ago, the founders of quantum physics postulated that you need consciousness in your equations to understand what's going on. And many physicists have rebelled violently at that, saying, no, there's no such thing as consciousness. You can't do that. And yet the mathematical formulas to do quantum physics require consciousness being put into the formula to make sense out of it.
Yeah, it's fascinating that even 100 years later, it's not really, I mean, it hasn't really come into the mainstream.
No.
Realized it, this. But so what do you think, if we are to talk a little bit about what's going to happen now in the future with this research and this worldview, this view on life, what will it take for society to come around and accept that there is something more to life and to death than what we can measure with physical instruments?
Well, that's a great question, Anders. I've just spent my career looking at scientific evidence, and that's ultimately not what convinces people. What convinces people is personal experience, usually. So I think the more we can do towards helping people have these experiences, whether it's by meditation or by other spiritual practices, the more we're going to find the whole consciousness of society starting to change. And certainly publicizing these more in the popular media has helped a great deal in opening up people's minds to these things.
Yeah. Do you think it would have been different if a different story, if the split between science and religion had never happened a few hundred years ago?
Definitely. When I've talked to about near-death experiences in other countries, for example, I had a chance to talk in Dharamsala, India, at a conference that the Dalai Lama put together. And I was talking about near-death experiences, and the monks all there all knew what I was talking about. They had no doubt about it. They were kind of surprised that Western science was studying this, but they had no doubt about them. They knew all about them.
Yeah. It's a pity that we went this, took this trajectory, but maybe there was some purpose to that as well. We have learned a lot along the way, but maybe it's time to put the baby back into the bathwater, as it were.
Yes. Yes. Well, my friends who are historians of science say that it was a political division between the church and the scientists, a way of avoiding a complete split. They just say, okay, science deals with the physical, we'll deal with the spiritual, and we won't talk about the interface. It was done for various non-scientific reasons. But now there have been surveys of scientists in several different countries that have shown that about half of all scientists now accept the fact that the brain and the mind are not the same thing.
Well, that's good news, I think.
Yes, that's very encouraging.
And the mind is such a good word to use. We don't have it in my mother tongue, Swedish. It's not. we have other words, but mind is very. It's a very good word to use to describe what's happening, I think. So, yeah. Bruce Grayson, where should people go now if they want to know more about you and your work and the work of your university?
My book is a good place to start. As you said, it's called After. My website, www.brucegrayson.com, has more information about that and about near-death experiences generally. And the International Association for Near-Death Studies, which is www.iands.org, has a lot of information on their website about near-death experiences and similar phenomena. They also have a scholarly journal, a quarterly periodical, and conferences all over the world about these phenomena. Another good site is the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, NDERF.org, which allows anybody to upload their own near-death experience onto the website. And there's some 5,000 experiences on there now. Hmm. So that's a goldmine of information.
Yeah, I gotta say. I will, of course, put links in the show notes underneath this video also. Bruce Grayson, it's been fascinating and a sheer joy to have you as a guest on the show. Thank you so much, and good luck with your continued research now.
Thank you, Anders, for having me on your show.